What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Professor Joni Magnus, archaeologist, excavator of Chukok Synagogue in the Galilee, author of Masada, From Jewish Revolt to Modern Myth, and president of the Archaeological Institute of America. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and meet our new Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about the incredible influence one book can have on your life. Sometimes a book a parent, friend, or teacher urges you to read transforms you in a profound way. Sometimes you hear a comment that makes you look up a particular author. Then you read his or her work and your life is different. Sometimes a book you happen to pick up at a friend or neighbor's home does it. But a book, not always a great book, just the right book at the right time, really can change your life. That came up as I was sending a donation to an organization I've supported for years, the Civil War Trust, that preserves land fought over during the American Civil War more than 150 years ago. It publishes a magazine called Hallowed Ground, a phrase incorrectly associated with Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Anyway, the magazine is strictly for us Civil War buffs. It describes how they save some parcel of land on a famous battlefield from development to preserve it for historical posterity. There are accounts of campaigns and biographies of leaders in the magazine that I enjoy, but this is a publication for people with a very specific interest. Nerds who care about the war between the states. True Civil War buffs intent on preserving some of the battlefields. Now, that may seem an odd thing for a rabbi to be, a Civil War buff, or even for a Jew. After all, most Jews in America are descended from the great wave of Eastern European Jewish immigrants who came to the U.S. from the 1880s to the 1920s, long after the end of the Civil War in 1865. At the time of that epic conflict, Jews made up just a tiny part of a pretty small U.S. population. And of the wartime military itself, close to 3 million men fought in the armies of North and South, and of these, perhaps 10,000 were Jewish, far more than our proportion of the population in America, but still not many compared to the millions of non-Jews who fought. Jews served in high office, especially in the Confederacy. Jews were generals, both North and South, and won military honors in the Civil War at a rate totally disproportionate to our numbers, including medals of honor. And Jews died, too, about 600 as soldiers during the war. Still, why did any of this interest a Jewish boy growing up in Los Angeles, California, very far from the major theaters of this old conflict? Well, I did later discover that I had relatives who served in the Union Army in the Civil War. They were Sephardic German Jews named Del Banco, three brothers, two of whom ended up listed missing in combat by the Union Army, never found. The third of whom, an early Reform rabbi, died when the steamboat he was on exploded as he returned north after conducting High Holy Day services for Union soldiers in Vicksburg, Mississippi, in 1864. But I didn't find out any of that until long after I had become a confirmed Civil War buff. Now, what led me to this strange passion was a free book that arrived unbidden at our home when I was 6 years old, the Pictorial Encyclopedia of American History, Volume 1, The Bitter War Between the States, about, yes, the Civil War. It was part of a series. You bought one volume at a time by subscription, and they sent you the first book free as a teaser. They then sent you more, and you were supposed to pay for them. Well, my parents were fine with me getting the first volume free, but not with buying the whole set. We already had an Encyclopedia Britannica, and so they sent back the second volume, and I never saw the rest of the set. But that first book was plenty. I read it and reread it and nearly memorized it, and I was hooked. One book at the right time, and I was a Civil War buff for life. You know, it can work that way with a novel or a nonfiction book, too, or with an inspirational text or philosophical or political book. You read a book and your eyes open up, and you are now officially different than you were. I'd like to suggest there's another book that has an almost infinite capacity to engage, entertain, and inspire. It is a far better known book than the Pictorial Encyclopedia of American History, volume on the Civil War. That book is called The Torah. When you read a modern translation of Torah, like those of Richard Elliot Friedman or Everett Fox or Robert Alter, you discover a fascinating, dramatic book that engages the mind, heart, and spirit, and creates as many questions as it answers. The stories in the Torah illustrate the complex ways in which we relate to God and to other human beings. They illuminate the challenges and rewards of family relationships, explore how our identities are shaped by our relationships to other people, to a larger people, to a nation, to a land of our own. The ethical and legal sanctions of the Torah show us how to frame a society based on justice and equity, on compassion and respect. The rituals help us to find holiness and the search for the sacred in our own lives and in the world. The best part about rereading the Torah is that it seems different every time you read it. That's true of a few great books, but not many. The reason the Torah seems to offer new meaning and message every time is not, of course, that the text itself changes. It is we who change over time, who relate differently to this book of extraordinary and eternal value. There are many great books, but if you seek a life-changing read this late summer or fall, I highly recommend you turn to the Torah. You'll be amazed by the result of focusing on this incredible book. And you can do it with me if you live in Tucson, Torah study Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock, or in our Genesis Project class, 11:45 on Thursdays. To play us in this morning, here's an unusual tune from a Jewish reggae group called Eighth Day. It's an English and Yiddish and Hebrew tribute to Torah.
Had no galaxy before the sun set the long night free, before the archers shot their miss, before the angels found their bliss. He looked inside, see what would be. Only then came you and me. Apaim shana kadma toira, kadma toira liyelam. Apaim shana kadma toira, kadma toira liyelam.
That was the song Torah by the group Eighth Day. Our guest this morning, Professor Jody Magnus, is an extraordinary archaeologist, excavator of the remarkable Chukok Synagogue in the Galilee, author of Masada, From Jewish Revolt to Modern Myth, and president of the Archaeological Institute of America. She's both a wildly accomplished archaeologist and a delightful interview. Find out what her newest finds are all about. Meet Jody Magnus when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball,
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Jody Magnus holds the senior endowed chair in the Department of Religious Studies at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, the Kenan Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism. She's a renowned archaeologist, president of the Archaeological Institute of America, has published at least 10 books, including a wonderful recent book on Masada, and is the excavator of one of the most interesting sites in the world, Hukok Synagogue floor in Israel today. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking about Hukok and tell us a little. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, by the way.
Close. It's Hukok.
Hukok. Okay.
Yep.
Sounds very Hukok-ish in some ways. tell us a little bit about the site itself and the importance of the discovery.
Right. Well, I started excavating there in 2011 in order to address a couple of large research questions that I had about the fate of Jewish settlements in Galilee against the background of the rise and spread of Christianity. Already that year, 2011, we came down on part of the wall of a monumental synagogue building, and the following year, 2012, we reached the floor and discovered it's paved with mosaics, and we've basically been bringing to light additional portions of the mosaics since then every summer. And it turns out that the mosaics are almost unparalleled in ancient Jewish art in general and ancient synagogues in particular. The floor is covered with panels that are divided into figured scenes. Most of them are biblical stories, although not quite all of them. And many of them depict stories that we had not previously had examples of in Jewish art. For example, we have a couple of scenes of Samson. We have a Jonah scene, which is actually the first time Jonah's ever been discovered in ancient Jewish art. And then we have a number of other scenes, some of which do have parallels and or are else very rare. And we also have the first apparently non-biblical story ever found decorating an ancient synagogue, although exactly what the story is depends on who you ask, because every person who sees it has a different interpretation. I think it's the legendary meeting between Alexander the Great and the Jewish high priest, but you can find at least eight or more other interpretations that have been published so far.
I'll trust you just because it's the coolest possible interpretation. I should note that these Byzantine mosaics are fantastic mosaics, just artistically, looking at some of the images online. And for those Jews who are unfamiliar with the fact that there are faces depicted, that's going to be startling.
Yes, that's right. So I should mention that the synagogue dates, based on the evidence that we've excavated, to the early 5th century, so a little bit after 400 CE. So we're basically talking late Roman period. I think probably a lot of people who are not specialists in the field, a lot of Jews would be surprised that we have a synagogue decorated so richly with figured images. But that in and of itself is not a new discovery. In fact, for well over a century, we've had synagogue buildings of this period brought to light that are decorated with figured images and biblical stories. So that's not a new discovery. What is new and different about our synagogue is the richness and diversity of the scenes that are depicted.
It's kind of fascinating to see Jonah for the first time from this period.
Yeah, and by the way, your listeners might be interested in checking out the images, which are most of which are published on our DIG website, which is just hukok.org, H-U-Q-O-Q.org.
We will talk much more with Jody Magnus about not only Hukok, but also Masada and kind of that entire period when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this fall, including our first High Holy Days. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night, 7315 North Oracle Road, for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all usually with me leading them. Join us for Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and our incredible array of adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue community in southern Arizona during its exciting beginning year. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akfel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week you mentioned you'd be going to a conference in the former Yugoslavia. I think that raises kind of the larger question of what is the Jewish community of the former Yugoslavia? What was the Jewish community of Yugoslavia? How did it get there? What's it all about? I don't think too many of us know much about it.
These are very good questions, and I have to say that when I lived and worked in Belgrade as a diplomat, Yugoslavia was still one unified country with multiple languages, two different alphabets, the Latin alphabet and the Cyrillic alphabet. And basically, at the risk of oversimplifying slightly, the eastern half of the former Yugoslavia was east of the line that Emperor Diocletian drew through the middle of his palace and split. And the eastern half is devoutly Orthodox in terms of its Christianity, and they use the Cyrillic alphabet, and their priests can be married, and the whole nine yards. Their patriarch was in Constantinople. The Roman Pope was for the Latin speakers in the western half of the country. And it's very interesting that this major cultural divide that really certainly divided the former Yugoslavia and much of Europe, in fact, goes back to a line drawn in the second century of the Common Era by a Roman emperor who lived in the what's today the Croatian city of Split. So the countries that exist today that emerged from the former Yugoslavia are, starting in the far northwest, Slovenia, which is a beautiful small alpine country with lakes and mountains and a seacoast. Its capital is Ljubljana. Geographically, it's probably the smallest in terms of square miles, although I'm not sure because the extreme southeastern countries might be just as small. Then moving southeast from there, you have Croatia, which is a very complicated place because there are different regions that have very different characters. There's the Dalmatian coast that was part of Venice for a long time and is Split and Dubrovnik and these gorgeous places. There's the inland upper mountains, and there's Slavonia, which was part of Austro-Hungary and sort of goes along the border with Austria and Hungary in the north. And then east of that is Serbia, and south of Serbia becomes very complicated because there is what used to be an autonomous province of Serbia called Kosovo that is now an independent country in the eyes of some people, not in the eyes of the Serbs. And apart from that, there's Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is a federation uneasily held together of Muslims, Roman Catholics, in Serbian Orthodox people and a few Jews. And south of that is what was until recently legally known as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and a cave to the Greeks who think that Macedonia is theirs, and the appropriation of that term by Tito was illegal and a slap in the face. And there's still great sensitivity over that. I think now it's called the Republic of Northern Macedonia.
There was almost a shooting war over that not too long ago.
There have been a lot of problems over the past, since the dissolution of the former Yugoslavia. It wasn't a problem in the old days. Once Macedonia, or whatever it's called, became an independent country with its capital in Skopje, the name became a huge issue. And then in the far southwest, there's this gorgeous country called Montenegro, which is all mountains and bays and a beautiful coast and a Riviera, gets lots of tourists. Lots of Russian oligarchs have moved there and have like huge boats and palaces, whatever. And at one point in time, all of these, what are now different countries, belong to Yugoslavia, and they all had, to one extent or another, Jewish communities. And I guess maybe next week we can talk about the Jewish communities in each of these different countries.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
Okay.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Friedman, a very wealthy, observant Jewish man, has just finished building his own 50-room mansion. Naturally, he needs to put up a mezuzah on every single door. That's a lot of work, so he calls his carpenter, asks him to bring some assistants over to install the mezuzahs while Friedman is on vacation. He returns vacation, and he finds a note on the kitchen counter from the carpenter. It reads, "Dear Mr. Friedman, we put up all the little boxes for you. We had a hard time getting the instructions out of every one. The papers are in the top drawer." You see, the point of a mezuzah is to have the parchment with the Shema on it inside on a little scroll. Forget it. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We are delighted to introduce to our two Jewish audience two new shinshinim, Shai Friedwald from Ramat Gan and Danielle Levy from Emek Yisrael, the Jezreel Valley, we would say in English. Welcome, Bruchim Habaim, welcome to America.
Thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, a story, something that tells us about your perspective on coming to be representatives, young representatives of Israel here in America.
So again, I'm Danielle. I lived for 6 years outside of Israel. I used to live in Finland for 3 years.
Finland is like the geographic opposite of Tucson.
Exactly,
right?
It is ice cold, absolutely. So I went to a Jewish kindergarten. I learned Finnish. Unfortunately, I forgot. Afterwards, my mom is from Germany, so I moved to Frankfurt in Germany. I lived there for another three years. I went to a Jewish school there. Learned German. I speak German. I read German. I can write German. And it's just like a fun perspective of seeing like Jewish communities all over the world, in Finland, in Germany, and now excited to discover the Jewish community here in Tucson.
Fascinating. You are the first person I have ever met, Jewish person, that lived in Finland.
Oh, so yeah.
This is a new experience for me, and I'm sure for our audience. Shai, tell us about your background a little bit.
All right. Yeah. So I'm Shai, but I'm not shy.
You're not shy.
Yeah. I'm 18 years old, as Daniel. I come from Ramat Gan. It's like 10 minutes driving from Tel Aviv. It's in the middle of Israel. Both of my parents are dentists, work together. I have two siblings.
So your teeth are great.
Yeah. Thank you very much. but today morning
Danielle's
I ate...
Danielle's teeth are very nice,
thank
too.
You.
Right?
Yeah.
Today morning I ate tricks. So.
Oh, this
yeah.
is your... America will destroy your teeth.
Yeah.
It's our goal.
Yeah. So I come from Ramat Gan. I used to be in the scouts. I was a guide.
Sofim, right?
Yeah, Sofim, for 4 years. And it took a really big part of my life. I also played volleyball.
So you played for Maccabi Tel Aviv?
Maccabi Tel Aviv.
Yeah. What position did you play?
Like, Matsliv.
Okay, so like, what's matzliv?
Because a cross, but
crossing.
Okay, like the setter. Like the setter or...
No, not the setter. Okay. Like the puncher.
Like the striker.
The striker. Wow, yeah. Okay. Striker and reception.
Very impressive.
Yeah.
Every striker I know is like 6'12".
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty short, but I can jump.
But you can jump, yeah. That's it.
Yeah, and also in love with American football.
Uh-huh.
So
we'll have to get your impressions when you go to some football games here in America,
of course,
because it's a big part. Listen, I just want to welcome you. We're thrilled to have you guys and looking forward to your impressions of America and your recollections of Israel. Welcome again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yisrael.
And now a word of Torah. Have you heard about the new movement in Judaism? It's not Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Reconstructionist, or even Renewal. It's called Cardiac Jews. You know, I'm Jewish in my heart. We usually think of this as a kind of abdication, meaning I'm Jewish in my heart, but I don't do anything about it in my actual daily life. Well, there is one sense in which being a cardiac Jew can have real meaning. In the middle of our weekly Torah portion of Akev, a great question is asked. What does the Lord your God ask of you? That you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in all of God's ways and love God, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. But Akev then follows this wonderful spiritual moral instruction with a puzzling passage in which it tells us to do something physically impossible. We are commanded to circumcise the foreskin of our hearts. If true, this would be a new kind of Brit Milah, one that smacks of flat-out self-murder. Circumcise our hearts? How do you do that with a flint knife on top of an Aztec temple pyramid? If we were to do that actual act, circumcising the heart, cutting off a flap of this essential human organ, we would, of course, die, no matter how skilled the moil was. That passage defines the fact that Torah was never meant to be read purely literally and makes it very clear that Torah is and always was a teaching tool to create and focus moral and spiritual direction, not a simplistic piece of ancient lore meant to be taken literally. So what does this metaphor mean? Well, it means that to truly love God, to walk in God's ways, to serve God, to love our fellow human beings, we have to change. Circumcise the foreskin of your hearts teaches us to open our hearts to God, to holiness, to goodness. In order to do what God asks in the ethical covenant established in Deuteronomy, we must remove the hard casing we construct over our innate humanity, the armor of ego, self-interest, and self-importance that builds up out of our insecurity or out of overconfidence. We must find a way to cut away the arrogance of the eternal critic or the cool hostility of the perpetual cynic. We must remove the snide pleasure of a circulator of Lashon Hara and the self-righteous anger of the eternally injured. We have to shut off the controlling negativity of the brain and let our hearts express the depth of feeling and empathy within them. When we remove this hard casing around our hearts, when we perform this spiritual Brit Milah, we can change ourselves for the better. For then we are able to open our hearts and feel and know that God is good and desires good, that what God wants is something we can offer. Akev advocates exploring how to fulfill God's desires, but that's no more than a means to create good in the world. One path of kindness, ethics, and personal respect. This is the heart of the matter. This is the lesson of the heart. Over the coming week, may we each learn to listen to our own hearts, get our heads out of the way long enough to touch the holiness within us. And then we may become truly cardiac Jews, Jews in our hearts, leading us to become truly Jewish in the best way, in every other aspect of our lives. Our guest this morning, Professor Jody Magnus, is one of the outstanding archaeologists in the world. Her remarkable and beautiful discoveries at the synagogue in Chukok in the Galilee open up new windows into Jewish life and synagogue life in the Byzantine world and beyond. Find out about these exciting new finds and about Masada when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Members of the Jewish community and supporters marked the annual day of mourning, Tisha B'Av, by taking to the streets last week in New York, protesting the treatment of immigrants by the Trump administration. Many were sent to jail. Dozens were arrested in the Jews Against ICE protest as demonstrators occupied an Amazon bookstore in Midtown Manhattan. Protesters demanded Amazon Web Services end cloud computing contracts with U.S. Customs and Enforcement and stop providing technical services that help agents track down immigrants. Those arrested were cheered on by crowds as they were led to a city bus commandeered by police to transport the detainees. In Rhode Island, later in the week, a group of Never Again demonstrators had a brutal experience when a man drove his pickup truck slowly into the crowd. No one was hurt. And then ICE personnel inside the detention center rushed out and pepper sprayed the Jewish demonstrators. Protesters also gathered in Washington, L.A., Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, and many other U.S. cities on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, the day when we Jews fast and remember the destruction of two ancient temples and other disasters suffered by our community. This time, these Jews chose to also mourn the suffering and fight for justice for immigrants in America. "We're demanding an end to this unfolding modern-day catastrophe," said the organization TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, one of many groups participating in the protest. Protesters wore T-shirts or held banners reading "Never Again." Others held signs underscoring comparisons between America and Hitler's Germany and concentration camps and migrant camps. "This is personal for the Jewish community," said Rabbi Yael Rappaport of Congregation Beit Simcha Torah, New York. "Public outcry, especially in our modern age, can really change attitudes and change policy. This is a deeply Jewish thing to do." Meanwhile, in Israel, the overlap of Jewish and Muslim holy days, the combination last Sunday when Eid al-Adha and Tisha B'Av fell on the same day, perhaps inevitably led to clashes near the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. When rumors circulated, as they so often do on the Arab street, that Israeli police were going to allow Jews to visit the Temple Mount during Muslim prayers, Palestinian demonstrators massed at the gates that lead to the Temple Mount. They began throwing stones at the police. In reaction to the Palestinian rioting and after an outcry by right-wing Israeli leaders, police reversed an earlier decision to bar Jewish visitors and let some of them up on the Temple Mount. The holy site has long been a flashpoint for Palestinian violence against Israelis, and typically when things seem sensitive, Israeli authorities will ban Jews from going up on Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount. I have experienced this personally many times. But this time, with Israel heading to elections next month, they changed their minds. As always, even the smallest perceived changes to the status of the site, the emotional and symbolic center of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, can spark Palestinian violence, or so it's interpreted. The Temple Mount is the holiest site in the world for Jews, of course, and perhaps the third holiest site in Islam, after Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. There, by the way, all non-Muslims are banned from visiting. Anyway, the Temple Mount was site of the first and second Jewish temples in antiquity. It is the home of the iconic gold Dome of the Rock monument and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The sacred Kotel, the Western Wall, is really just a retaining wall for the Temple Mount. Tens of thousands of Muslims flocked to the Temple Mount last Sunday to mark the start of Eid al-Adha, the Muslim holiday honoring the moment in Genesis during the Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, when God stayed Abraham's hand after asking him to sacrifice his son. Simultaneously, hundreds of thousands of religious Jews and visitors from all around the world came to the Kotel, the Western Wall, just below the Temple Mount, observing Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av.
By Israeli government choice, the Temple Mount area itself, El-Aqsa, and the Dome of the Rock are all managed by the Waqif, an Islamic trust under Jordanian stewardship, and day-to-day affairs are governed by informal understandings with Israel known as the status quo. Palestinians fear any erosion of the status quo might lead to Israelis taking over the site. They could actually do that any time, but anyway. Although Palestinians often take advantage of their protected status and try to destroy all archaeological record of Jews having been on the site. According to the status quo, Jews are allowed to visit the Temple Mount during certain times, but are always forbidden to pray there. The Islamic Trust overseeing the site, the Waqif, said it was unprecedented and unacceptable to allow Jews to visit during a major Muslim holiday, even though it was also a Jewish sacred day. On Muslim holidays, the site is always closed to non-Muslims in respect for the special sanctity of the days, said Daniel Seideman, founder of Terrestrial Jerusalem, a group that tracks what's going on in the Holy City. That basically was violated for the first time when Jerusalem Day and the final days of Ramadan overlapped this June, and it happened again on Tisha B'Av. In response, the Waqif said it took the exceptional decision to delay morning prayers, typically held at 6:30 a.m., by an hour, just so they would conflict with normal visiting hours. Soon after the morning prayers, the Palestinian riots erupted. As usual, they got the worst of it. 14 Palestinians and 4 Israeli policemen were hurt. For decades, Orthodox rabbis forbade Jews to visit the site altogether, but a growing number of religious rabbis have now endorsed visiting the Temple Mount. Jewish visits have been increasing slightly in recent years. 1,700 Jews visited Temple Mount last Sunday, compared to 1,400 on Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, last year. That is still a very modest number compared to the thousands of Muslims who visit daily, or the hundreds of thousands of Jews who visit the Kotel on Jewish festivals and fast days. Jerusalem District Police Chief Doron Yadid said it was the Waqif that violated the status quo by delaying prayers just to provoke a confrontation. Temple Mount remained closed to non-Muslim visitors until Thursday, following the end of the holiday of Eid al-Adha. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has repeatedly said he has no intention of changing the status quo, despite calls from his right-wing allies for expanded Jewish access. Nonetheless, Israeli hardliners hailed the Tisha B'Av visit as a victory of some kind. Asaf Fried, spokesman for a nutcase group calling for building a third temple immediately, said, "You need to remember that since the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem in 637 CE, not a single Jewish foot stood on the Temple Mount on a Muslim holiday." That is sort of true. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Jody Magnus is one of the, I think, most important archaeologists in the world today, the excavator of the magnificent synagogue in Hukok, author of Masada, From Jewish Revolt to Modern Myth, which was published earlier this year, a distinguished professor, head of the American I don't know, your CV is just too long. Let's...
Someday when they excavate the University of North Carolina, they'll find this like elaborate, you know, description.
I don't know how you balance it all, but I want to go back to the synagogue and the period, the synagogue that you're excavating at Hukok and the excavation and that particular period. One of the fascinating things we think about the destruction of the temple, the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the gradual degradation of Jewish life in Israel, the center moving to Babylon with the Babylonian Talmud, and yet there's a very vital Jewish life producing things like the so-called Jerusalem Talmud. There's definitely a lot going on in Israel in the period that we're talking about, and this the synagogue mosaics really point to that, don't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's actually exactly the reason why I undertook this excavation project, because there is a view prevalent among many of my Israeli colleagues in particular that beginning in the mid-4th century, Jewish settlement in Eastern Galilee, and especially Lower Eastern Galilee, which is where Hukok is located,
so pretty close declined. To Tiberias, for those people who know
that's
the
right.
geography.
That's right. That's right. It's the area Tiberias. Sort of off the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. So, yes, if you move from Tiberias northwards towards Capernaum and then a little bit inland, basically in the Roman period, Eastern Galilee was Jewish. And it was Western Galilee that became Christian early on, but Eastern Galilee was really a bastion of Jewish settlement. This prevalent view is that beginning in the mid-4th century, Jewish settlement in this region declined quite precipitously, and many of the settlements were abandoned. And this view is conditioned not just by the interpretation of the archaeological evidence, but by the fact that the Jerusalem Talmud was never completed. Apparently, it ceased to be edited, you know, sometime around this period, right, around mid-4th century or so. Of course, it's around this time that we begin to have the rise and spread of Christianity. Christianity becomes a legal and then an official religion.
State religion.
In the Roman
Constantine,
Empire.
Constantine, right.
That's right. And these Jewish settlements come under what becomes called Byzantine Christian rule. That sort of is a very prevalent view. And my impression from the archaeological evidence is that, in fact, the opposite is the case, that Jewish settlements in this region continued to flourish through the 4th century, through the 5th century, and through the 6th century. And that was why I undertook the excavations at Hukok, was in order to sort of see, well, we have a Galilean village in this area, you know, Jewish village, let's test this view. And so you're right, the remains that we've been bringing to light, and in particular this very large and richly decorated synagogue building, contradict that view.
In that area, there are so many remarkable archaeological sites. Speaking of someone who leads trips to Israel, loves going to visit these sites, when will this be something that people can view?
When are these, I gotta know, when will these mosaics be something that we can look at?
Well, right. So first of all, I'm glad you asked, because first of all, let me say that there's nothing to see at the site now. We removed the mosaics for conservation. We backfill all of the excavated areas. There's nothing to see at the site. So please don't take anybody there. Don't have people running off.
I promise.
Yeah, there's nothing to see there. But the question of the future development of the site, fortunately, is not up to me. It's not my responsibility. So as the archaeologist excavating the site, I'm responsible for the excavation, the conservation, and publication. But the future development of the site for tourism is not up to me. It's up to the Israeli government authorities. Now, as you can imagine, there's been a huge amount of interest in our discoveries, both among the Israeli public in general, but also among many of the government authorities. And what we have right now is a situation where there are many different government authorities that are involved, and if and when the site will be developed for tourism will depend on their sort of collaborating with each other, finding the money to make it happen, and then, you know, and then going ahead and doing it. So there's been a lot of talk. There have been some preliminary steps that have been taken to, you know, develop a blueprint, let's say, for the development.
Sure.
But if and when it will actually happen will depend not on me, but on, you know, on authorities that are way beyond my pay grade. What I tell people is that I think it will happen. I just think, you know, it's such an extraordinary discovery. It is, after all, a synagogue, and we're in Israel, so hello.
Yeah.
So I think it will eventually happen. But what I tell people is I don't think it will happen anytime soon. It will take time for that to happen. It will take time for the government authorities to work it out, and it will then, you know, take time for the actual development of the site. So in the meantime, check out our website, you know, to keep updated on what we have and to see the images, and then just hope that, you know, they can all make it happen as soon as possible. But I don't think it'll be that soon.
I understand. For those of us who have seen Tsipori and the mosaics there, can you draw some analogies or time period comparisons?
Oh, yeah. Actually, very interesting. So, you know, there is a synagogue at Sepphoris, which is a very interesting synagogue. And it's interesting because it's roughly contemporary with our synagogue. The excavators of Weiss dates their synagogue to the early 5th century, which would make it pretty much contemporary with our synagogue. But it is actually a different kind of synagogue building. So we have over 120 known ancient synagogues in Israel, not all of which have been excavated. And because there are so many, and most of them are in the northern part of the country, so in Galilee and the Golan, they can be grouped into types of buildings. So they cluster. So you can distinguish, you know, buildings with different layouts and with different kinds of decorations and so on. And our synagogue at Hukok belongs to a kind of building, a type that's called the Galilean type synagogue, which is a type that occurs only in Galilee, but not all synagogues in Galilee are Galilean type. And the best example of a Galilean type synagogue is the one at Capernaum, which is just a couple of miles away from ours.
Yeah, another fantastic site, I might add.
Exactly. And these are buildings that are characterized by being large rectangular basilicas. That's a basilica layout, with columns wrapping around three sides of the interior, dividing the building into a central hall with these aisles on the sides. They're constructed of large blocks of stone, what's called ashlar masonry, and the entrance or entrances to the building are in the south wall, which in Galilee is the Jerusalem-oriented wall. So when you entered the building, you actually had to turn completely around in order to face the direction of prayer. So that's the kind of building that we have at Hukok. But the difference is that we have actually a little sort of subtype of the Galilean type, because most of the Galilean type synagogues, like Capernaum, have flagstone pavements inside the building, and we have mosaics. So there's a very small number of Galilean type synagogues that have mosaic floors. Now, the synagogue at Sepphoris is not this type of building. It's actually a kind of a strange building in a way, because it's lacking an aisle. It's really weird. It's like long and narrow. So it has a nave, and it has an aisle on one side, but it lacks an aisle on the other side. It's a little bit weird, and it's different in that when you entered, you did not turn around to face the direction of prayer. So it's a little bit of a, in terms of the type of building, it's a little bit different. It's more like, it's not exactly the same, but it's more like what are called in Israel Byzantine-type synagogues, which are synagogues which are laid out like Byzantine churches, where you have sort of this kind of, again, a basilical hall, but two rows of columns instead of three that divide it into the nave, and then two aisles on either side. And then you enter the building. In Galilee, you would enter from the north wall, and you'd be facing, you know, automatically the direction of prayer. Usually in a building like this, you don't have it at Sepphoris. You would have a big semicircular niche or apse in the Jerusalem-oriented wall for the Torah shrine. But anyway, so in those kinds of buildings, and the best example that I can give you of this one would be Beit Alpha at the foot of Mount Gilboa.
Another great site.
Exactly. And by the way, this is not exactly the same kind of building, but in terms of the mosaics, it's the kind of same thing. At Hamat Tiberias also, you have mosaic floors. So when in Israel you have synagogues decorated with mosaic floors that have figured images in them, figured panels, generally speaking, those figured panels are limited only to the nave, to the center of the hall. And that's what you have at Sepphoris. That's also what you have at Hamat Tiberias, for example, and so on and so forth. Our synagogue differs in having figured panels covering the entire floor, so also the aisles and also the nave. And that seems to be one of the characteristics of this subtype of Galilean-type synagogue. So although we're contemporary with, this is really getting into really nerdy, you know, detailed stuff, but although our synagogue is contemporary with Sepphoris, it's actually different from Sepphoris in many other ways.
I want to shift to talking about Masada. You were co-director of excavations there. Your book came out on it just this past year. Actually, this year.
Masada from
Jewish. Yeah, it came out in May.
Yeah. It's pretty.
Just a couple of
so
months
it's pretty
ago, yeah.
fresh. People can
it's
still
fresh.
Find it,
it's
and they should
fresh.
Get it.
Yeah.
Masada
yeah.
from Jewish Revolt to Modern Myth. Tell us what prompted you to write it. And I mean, Masada has been such a powerful concept, but a lot of what people know about it is maybe not the whole story.
probably not. Well, yeah, let me just clarify that I did co-direct excavations at Masada, but they were not on top of the mountain. The excavations on top of the mountain were, of course, directed by the famous Israeli archaeologist Yigal Yadin back in the 1960s. That's right.
Right.
I co-directed excavations in the Roman siege works at Masada in the summer of 1995.
The bad guys, according to tradition here. So.
Yeah, well, actually, it gives you a whole other perspective on the story. But anyway, so what prompted me to write the book was a very persistent editor at Princeton University Press. And, I had no intention of writing a book like this, but he was determined to persuade me to do it, and he persisted. He bugged me for a very long time until he finally wore me down, and I agreed to do it. I write this actually at the beginning of the preface, and I'm glad that he persisted and persuaded me. And the reason is because so it's a trade book, right? It's a book that's aimed at non-specialists. So you know, anybody who's like a specialist in archaeology or history of the late Second Temple period probably will be a little bit disappointed. It's not aimed at that kind of specialization. But it is intended to help people understand better the story of Masada, but not just the story of Masada. What I found is that when I started to write the book, Masada is an ideal lens through which to tell the history of the Jews in the late Second Temple period, because, of course, the story of Masada begins in the Hasmonean period, which is where Josephus begins his account of the Jewish war, because, according to Josephus, and anyway, the first person to fortify the top of Masada was one of the Hasmonean kings, one of the successors of the Maccabees. And then the story ends, and this is where Josephus ends his story of the Jewish war, with the siege and fall of Masada. So it's actually a perfect way to sort of, you know, use Masada as a way of relating the larger history of the Jews in the late Second Temple period. And that's what I do in the book. So it's also not just about Masada. It's sort of to tell the story of Masada, but to acquaint readers with sort of the broader events of the period.
It's a fascinating book, and it shows many aspects of that that we wouldn't know about. You know, what were the Romans like? What was it like to be Jewish under the Roman rule? I think it's a great introduction. But even for people that do know about that period, a really rich and useful book, too.
Well, thank you.
Sure. Where can people go to find out more about Hukok and about you and about your work?
Thanks for asking. The DIG website is very easy. It's not so easy because Hukok, which is actually a simple name, looks very strange when it's written in English because of the transliteration of the Hebrew letters. So it's written H-U-Q-O-Q. So the DIG website is hukok.org, H-U-Q-O-Q.org. So that's very easy. My own website is just my name, all one word, .org, jodymagnus.org, so very easy to find me. And the Masada book was published by Princeton University Press. If you just, you know, Google my name and go to Princeton University Press or Amazon, it's also on Amazon, you can find the book.
I should also note your website is one of the cooler academic websites I've ever seen. You've got, like, these great pictures of rocks and mosaic woven into your name. And whoever did it for you, if you didn't do it yourself, it's really...
I did not do it, and thank you for saying that, because it was one of my advanced PhD students who's the webmaster, both of my website and the DIG website. So his name's Brad Erickson, and he deserves the credit.
Absolutely. Vishay Momro. Jody, thank you so much for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball,
Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Yuval David, Israeli-American actor, director, social activist who is featured in the upcoming TV series based on the Philip Roth novel, The Plot Against America. Our play out this morning comes from Rabbi Yitzi Hurwitz and his collaboration song, Shine a Little Light, featuring Jewish musical stars from around the world. He wrote it before being diagnosed with ALS. It was recorded to help him with his medical bills, and it's a beautiful song. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
to be all that you wanna be. But it's so cold now, it's so dark here. What could I do? It's not very clear.
Shine a little light, show us the way, lead us to a brighter day. Shine a little light, show us the way, lead us to a brighter day.
If I'm a little light, you're a little light. Together we are.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.